At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
We have got a lot to talk about. The economic week that was, the global shipping slowdown, bees. So let's get right to it, shall we? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Baltimore, I'm Amy Scott, in for Kai Rizdahl. It's Friday, September the 16th. Good to have you with us. This was one of those weeks where we got lots of information, but not necessarily a whole lot of clarity about what's going on with the U.S. economy. Never fear, that is what the weekly wrap is all about. We've got Catherine Rampell here today. She's a columnist at The Washington Post. Sudeep Reddy is managing editor at Politico. Hi, you two.
Hi, Amy.
Hi.
Sudeep, let's start with you, and I'm going to kind of tick through some of the big data points this week. Of course, we had the latest inflation numbers out early in the week. Consumer prices up 0.1% in August from July. Producer prices down by the same amount. What does that tell you about the state of the economy right now and what the Fed is going to have to do to get this under control? Sudeep, I'm not hearing you. Can you hear us?
I've lost you there, but I think I'm back now.
Oh, good. Yeah, you're there. So let's talk about inflation and what the news of the week told you about the economy.
Yes, we really saw it with some surprises on the inflation front, actually, with some of the core measures. So the underlying inflation, when you exclude food and energy, that was actually a lot higher than expected. And I think it delivered a bit of a jolt to what folks were thinking about the economy. We thought inflation was coming down. We thought things were moderating. We thought maybe we might have seen the worst of it. And this was one of those things that it obviously surprised a lot of economists. It shocked the stock market for a day or two. And it really set expectations for the Fed coming into next week about what we'd be seeing coming ahead. And so that is just a big unknown now hanging over us, if whether inflation for all sorts of core underlying reasons other than the price of fuel and gasoline and all that, whether we've just got this baked-in inflation that's going to get worse and worse now.
Yeah, Catherine, what do you think this means for next week's meeting? I mean, we're expecting a 75 basis point increase. Is that all but guaranteed at this point?
It certainly seems that way. I mean, I did see some analysts saying, well, maybe the Fed is going to try to surprise everyone with an even bigger rate hike, you know, like a full percentage point. I don't know that they're going to do that. I do think that the Fed's approach to all of this right now is to look really, really hawkish, really serious about inflation, in the hopes that they don't have to actually act as hawkishly later on, right? I mean, they care about expectations. They care about credibly looking committed to getting inflation under control, in which case the hope is that will reset behavior. That if everybody believes the Fed is going to take the punch bowl away effectively, then they're not going to preemptively raise prices because they expect everyone else to be raising prices. So, you know, the Fed is going to talk a tough game. They're probably going to raise at least 75 basis points next week. the real question is, will that be enough to get expectations, or keep expectations anyway, as low as they want them to be, and therefore hopefully prevent much more painful rate hikes later on, which would raise the risk of a recession.
Right. We also had the latest poverty numbers out from the Census Bureau, and there was some pretty good news there, but maybe temporary. Sudeep, going back to you, what's the story there?
You know, we had a huge increase, of course, in transfer payments, government support, child care, tax benefits, a lot of things that came up. If you look at the 2021 calendar year, the big year of tremendous stimulus, and that was really one of the historic moments in bringing down poverty, bringing down some of the worst measures that hadn't been addressed. And it's kind of the case study that I think economists can study for decades from now of how you do bring poverty down for the people who are having the greatest difficulty. What we will also see, I think, when these numbers come out a year from now, is that this current year, 2022, was probably the year when a lot of the workers on the lowest end of the income spectrum have done better than they have in many prior years in terms of wage gains. And so there will probably be another year of improvement of a different kind, though obviously inflation is eating a lot into people's incomes these days and their wages. And so you've got a couple of trends that look good, and hopefully we can see them continue, if not for those dark clouds hanging over us about what will happen in the global economy and the U.S. economy in the stretch ahead.
Yeah, it was a really remarkable story with child poverty down almost in half, cut almost in half. So we will be watching to see if that holds up. But Catherine, heading over to the consumer and retail, we saw this week retail sales were up 0.3% in August, though if you take away cars and trucks, actually down. How is the American consumer holding up with all the inflation we've been talking about?
Yeah, it was kind of a mixed bag, right? I think, again, this is sort of what the Fed wants to see. They're raising rates in the hope that they will cool demand, including consumer demand. So if you do see a slowdown in retail sales, or even a decline in retail sales, again, excluding motor vehicles and parts, you know, as long as it's not too sharp of a decline, that may be what the Fed is looking for. But inflation is painful. And it does, you know, some combination of inflation and higher borrowing costs do seem to be weighing on consumers. And the question is, what will that look like in the months ahead? You know, we also got some consumer sentiment data this week that looked a little bit more positive. So consumers aren't completely bummed out, even if they are, you know, spending less in general on non-auto related things. They seem to be a little more optimistic than they had been. But again, that's like from it's a pretty low bar. Consumer sentiment was at a historic low before. You know, consumers, they're struggling a little bit, but maybe just the right amount of struggle for what the Fed wants.
So, Sudeep, before we wrap up, I did want to talk about the rail strike that was averted this week and what that might have done to the economy. Crisis averted?
Likely crisis averted in this moment. This really would have been a punch to the economy that we could not sustain in this moment. We've already seen enough issues with food prices across the country. Obviously, last year was a story about all sorts of other goods going up due to supply chain issues. This is the ultimate supply chain issue. If you can't get crops to where they need to go, if you can't get food on grocery store shelves, this is just like a straight heart attack to the economy that was averted. It makes it a huge difference to not add on yet another problem, particularly from an inflation perspective, but just to mm-hmm. add to all of our economic angst in this moment. That's not what anybody needed. And it does show this is a moment. There are obviously a lot more threats of strikes and strikes going on, and labor shortages as a result of workers feeling like this is the moment to push for more benefits, higher wages, whatever you need to deal with an inflation problem. But this is these are the kinds of things that add up to large crises if you don't deal with them. And this is hopefully the kind of thing that if it gets fully approved and cleared from by all the unions involved, we won't have to worry about for the near future. But it is a sign of how fragile the system can be at any moment.
Yeah. Well, we've got to leave it there. But thank you both so much. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico and Catherine Rampell at The Washington Post. Have a great weekend.
Thanks, you too.
Have a good weekend.
On Wall Street today, a down day to end a down week. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. As we just discussed with Sudeep and Catherine, the ball is in the Fed's court. We'll see how aggressively officials plan to fight inflation when the Federal Open Market Committee meets next week. The point of raising interest rates is to cool demand by making it more expensive to borrow money. And while that hurts, if you want to buy a house or a car or take out a student loan, the upside is that we should be earning more on our savings. So why then are savings account rates just starting to inch up? Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer explains.
The Federal Reserve has been raising interest rates for about 5 months now, and yet the average rate on its savings account is a paltry 0.13%, according to Bankrate, partly because of our old friend's supply and demand. Lauren Goodwin is an economist at New York Life Investments, and she says over the past few years, people fattened up their savings account balances with pandemic relief money. So
banks have more deposits than they can find a home for.
Banks use the money in our savings account to make loans, but they have more deposit money than they need for those loans right now. Goodwin says the glut of deposits is getting smaller, though, because the pandemic relief programs ended and people are getting out and spending more.
The supply and demand that banks have for cash, that dynamic is changing again. And that's part of the reason why we are starting to see savings and checking rates move a little bit higher.
Online banks pay the highest rates on savings accounts, sometimes 10 times higher than the average rate, according to Chanel Bissett with NerdWallet.
And that's mostly because online banks don't have the overhead that large traditional brick-and-mortar banks do.
But even online interest rates on savings accounts are still below where they were the last time we had a series of interest rate increases from the Fed several years ago. Ken Tooman, senior savings analyst at LendingTree, says in the beginning of 2019, online banks were offering an average rate of about 2.2% on savings accounts. Now the online average is about 1.8%. Tooman says part of the problem is banks aren't lending as much now.
As loan growth goes down, banks have less of a need for deposits and less of a reason to raise rates.
Tooman says unlike in 2019, some banks today are worried about a recession, so they're pickier about who they lend money to because more people default on loans during economic slowdowns. I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
In the San Francisco Bay Area, thousands of dead fish have washed up on shores in recent weeks. A toxic algae bloom or red tide killed species of all kinds, from anchovies and crabs to large sturgeons and sharks. While the bloom has largely dissipated, preventing similar disasters in the future could cost the region billions of dollars. KQED's Leslie McClurg has more.
In late July, Mary Spicer noticed the water lapping around her kayak started to turn red. A few weeks later, it was dark brown.
All of a sudden, you could no longer see through the water.
Spicer paddles several times a week on the San Francisco Bay. She has never seen a red tide or algal bloom like this year's.
None of the marine people I know, the rowers, the paddlers, the sailors, are comfortable with what's happening right now.
An estuary connects the bay to Lake Merritt, a few miles inland in Oakland. A group of people stare wide-eyed from the shore there. Sabrina Wicker plugs her nose.
I thought it was like leaves or something, but it's like all those are all fish of all different sizes floating, dead.
The sandy beach below her feet is a web of twisted, tiny dead fish. Headlines about muddy waters and decaying fish are bad for tourism.
It might be a reason not to rent a kayak out of Sausalito and tool along the waterfront. It might be a reason not to visit the waterfront, you know, near Emeryville or in Oakland.
Rufus Jeffress is with the Bay Area Council, a business-sponsored public policy organization. Fishermen say they've had guests cancel charter fishing trips.
How widespread, how deep that is, hard to tell.
Jeffress says the full brunt of financial impacts may not be known for many months. The red tide is likely driven by a combination of warmer water temperatures resulting from climate change and high nutrient levels in the water. Eileen White is the executive officer for the San Francisco Bay Regional Water Board.
Unfortunately, we have not seen an algae bloom of this particular species of this magnitude in San Francisco Bay ever before that we know of.
The problem is high levels of nitrogen and phosphorus, which algae love to eat.
When you flush the toilet every day, you're flushing nutrients down and it arrives at the wastewater treatment plant.
And those plants remove sewage, but most do not filter out nutrients before discharging into the bay. Fixing the problem will cost upwards of $12 billion, maybe twice that much. That's according to the Bay Area Clean Water Agencies, which represents wastewater treatment plants. Lorian Fono is the executive director.
So we're hoping that this crisis becomes an opportunity to go after some of the state and federal infrastructure funding that is available right now.
Any remaining costs will be tacked onto residential sewage bills. In addition to upgrading filtering systems at treatment plants, communities can construct wetlands along shorelines. The soil and vegetation help remove nutrients.
You get benefits of sea level rise protection. You get the benefit of habitat enhancement.
Communities can also recycle treated wastewater by putting it on golf courses, farms, or sports fields, which would help the region become more drought resilient. All of these methods are expensive and can take 5 to 10 years to put in place. Plus, they hinge on a critical question that scientists are still trying to answer. What level of nutrients can the bay handle?
So the only thing that is worse than a recurrence of this devastating algal bloom in the bay is to spend billions and billions of dollars on reducing nutrients and have it not make a difference.
Back on the water, kayaker Mary Spicer says she hopes officials act quickly.
I feel if we humans are playing a role in creating it, then we really need to come up with solutions.
Scientists say red tides are more likely to occur as the climate warms. In San Francisco, I'm Leslie McClurg for Marketplace.
Coming up,
the economy has certainly impacted my ability to do business.
Wait, there's a B economy? First, though, let's do the numbers. The Dow Jones Industrial Average lost 139 points, 0.4% to close at 30,822. The Nasdaq fell 103 points, 0.9% to finish at 11,448. And the S&P 500 shed 28 points, 0.7% to end at 3873. For the week, the Dow was down 4.1%. The Nasdaq dropped nearly 5.5%. The S&P shed 4.8%. Nancy Marshall-Genzer told us about banks offering higher rates on savings accounts. Citigroup lost 0.7%. Bank of America dropped 1.1%. JPMorgan Chase was down almost 0.7%. Bond prices were essentially flat. The yield on the 10-year T-note is at 3.45%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Looking for the highest interest rate on your cash? At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's a higher rate than Robinhood, a higher rate than SoFi, a higher rate than Marcus, a higher rate than Wealthfront, frankly, a higher rate than Capital One, a higher rate than Ally, a higher rate than Barclays, a way higher rate than Bank of America and Chase, a higher rate than Citi, Wells Fargo, Discover, and it's a higher rate than American Express, too. So if you want to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash, check out public.com. We can't say it's the highest interest rate, but it's pretty darn up there. This is paid for by public investing, 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with public investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither public investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
Now your ideas don't have to wait. Now they have everything they need to come to life. Dell Technologies and Intel are creating technology that loves ideas, loves expanding your business, evolving your passions. We push what technology can do, so great ideas can happen right now. Find out how to bring your ideas to life at Dell.com. Welcome to Now.
Behind every successful business is a story, and some of them might surprise you. Like how Chobani's first yogurt factory was discovered on a piece of junk mail. Or how the founder of the multi-million dollar cosmetics brand Drunk Elephant was told by everyone, including her own mother, that the name sounded like a dive bar. On the podcast How I Built This, host Guy Raz talks to founders behind the world's biggest companies to learn how they built them. In each episode, you'll hear entrepreneurs share moments of doubt, failure, and how they were able to overcome setbacks on their way to the top. How I Built This is like a masterclass in innovation and creativity, a how-to guide for navigating life's challenges from the people who've done it all. Follow How I Built This wherever you get your podcasts. Listen early and ad-free right now on Wondery Plus. For more business content like this, listen on Wondery, the destination for business podcasts. With shows like How I Built This, Business Wars, and many more, Wondery means business.
This is Marketplace. I'm Amy Scott. One company we didn't get to in the numbers, FedEx. Its shares fell more than 20% today after the company said yesterday it's seeing a decline in shipping volume both in the U.S. and abroad. In an interview with CNBC, FedEx's CEO said he believes the slowdown is a sign that a global recession is coming. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has more.
Freight volume is generally a good indicator of economic activity because all those goods being shipped on planes, someone bought them. Adi Tomer is a senior fellow at the Brookings Institution.
So when we see major logistics firms like FedEx report disconcerting results, it can send up alarm bells for all kinds of economic onlookers.
FedEx is blaming a weakening economy in Asia for the decrease in shipping volume. And yeah, that's part of it, says Bank of America analyst Ken Hexter. But
part of it is self-inflicted.
6 years ago, for example, FedEx bought a European company called TNT. And almost right away, it got hit by a cyber attack. Hexter says that's caused disruptions to service pretty much ever since.
And anytime you have service issues, customers flee to competitive networks.
Hexter also points out that half of FedEx's business comes from its express service, which is when people want a package like yesterday. That means it can't hold planes, even if they're not totally full.
If volumes start to decline and now your planes are 80% full instead of 90% full or 70% full, you still have to fly the plane. So you have the fixed cost without the revenue.
FedEx announced that it's reducing the frequency of its flights and closing more than 90 FedEx office locations in an effort to cut costs, all of which is unusual in the lead up to the holidays. Matthias Winkenbach is a research scientist at the MIT Center for Transportation and Logistics. He says the cuts indicate FedEx is anticipating the holiday season will fall short of expectations.
Typically, shippers at this time of the year invest into having excess capacity, having rather too many than too few trucks on the road.
Winkenbach is worried a downturn might prompt FedEx and other logistic companies to change how they approach necessary innovations.
Think about electrification of fleets. Think about more sustainable delivery models.
He wonders whether FedEx and its competitors will see a downturn as a reason to scale down those efforts or double down on them. I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
A new business usually starts with an idea, then comes the hard work of making it a reality, and maybe some luck. A little buzz can certainly help, and that's the theme of today's installment of our series, My Economy.
My name is Erica Thompson. I live in Elgin, Texas, and I'm the founder and owner of Texas BeWorks. I started my business, Texas Bee Works, in 2016 while I was working a full-time, fast-paced office job as a communications director for a nonprofit association. And I would do bee work on nights, weekends, even lunch breaks. And I knew that keeping bees was what I wanted to dedicate all of my time and energy to, but I didn't exactly know how to do that. So I knew I wanted to figure out how to turn my passion into a way to make ends meet. And in trying to figure that out, I just sort of started saying yes to all the bee-related opportunities that would come my way. I kept bees for people who wanted bees on their land but didn't want to be beekeepers themselves. I taught beekeeping classes. So after building my business, I quit my full-time office job and I became a full-time beekeeper in 2018. And I was happily running a successful beekeeping business when in 2020, I joined TikTok and everything changed for me. I started sharing my bee work with the world, and I think within maybe 6 months or so of posting my first video online, I had a video of me doing a bee removal that went viral. And that was the first time my life sort of changed. For me as a beekeeper, some of my largest expenses come from the equipment that's used to house the bees, the beehive boxes, and also, of course, transportation costs. You know, I spend a lot of time in my truck driving around, trying to help people and bees all over Central Texas. So, you know, the economy has certainly impacted my ability to do business, you know, and at the start of the pandemic, we saw the prices of woodenware, of the beekeeping equipment rise significantly, of course, along with fuel cost and shipment cost. And, you know, for someone like me, I'm ordering my equipment by the pallet. So it can really make a difference when you're ordering that large of equipment. Bees are responsible for pollinating one out of every three bites of food we eat. And I don't think people realize how important bees are to not only our food system, but also our ecosystem. And our food system has been designed in a way that we rely on the work of bees and beekeepers. And so I hope that people just have a better understanding of the work that bees and beekeepers do.
That was Erica Thompson in Texas. We rely on you to do this series, so please head on over to marketplace.org/myeconomy and let us know what's going on in yours. This final note, if you missed the Marketplace Morning Report this morning, my colleague David Brancaccio interviewed Kate Kelly of The New York Times about her investigation into stock trading by members of Congress. Kelly and her team found 97 senators and representatives had made stock trades that could present a conflict of interest. This week, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi said the House would soon vote on legislation to ban individual stock trading by members of Congress, as well as their spouses and dependent children. In the meantime, Bloomberg reports some enterprising investors will soon offer a way for the rest of us to take part. A firm called Subversive Capital, pretty apt, plans to launch a pair of exchange-traded funds that mirror the holdings of members of Congress and or their spouses, one for Democrats, ticker symbol NANC, and one for Republicans, KRUZ. Okay, here's your moment of economic context. Gas keeps falling. AAA says the average price of a gallon going into the weekend is $3.69. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. And I'm Amy Scott. We will see you on Monday. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.